time now for America in the Balance. Brought to you by Oklahomans for Sovereignty and Free Enterprise. And now your co-hosts, Amanda Teagarden and Don Wyatt.
And welcome, freedom-loving Oklahomans, to another hour of America in the Balance on Truth in Focus Internet Radio. This is Amanda Teagarden in studio with my co-host, Don Wyatt.
Delighted to be here. We got a little bit of a gully washer today.
We did. We're both with OK Safe. That's Oklahomans for Sovereignty and Free Enterprise. The website is ok-safe.com, S-A-F-E.com. We've got another website called exposinghealthcarereform.com. Don, what do you think that one's about?
Something about healthcare, maybe?
ExposingHealthcareReform.com. Our third website, which is new and still in the process of being developed, is StopSmartMetersInOklahoma.org. And Don, you have a couple of websites.
I'm involved with a couple of other websites, too. Tulsa912Project.com, just like it sounds, Tulsa, and then the numbers 912Project.com. And a spinoff from that called boondoggleblog.com. If you're interested in reading about things that make you want to rip your hair out, ways in which our public funds are abused and misused, that's a good place to go read about them.
It is. Lots of local politics, but those local politics, I'm pretty sure, will apply to the same things that are happening in your town.
Whatever's happening in Tulsa is probably happening in every other town in the country.
We are broadcasting from Oklahoma, and we are in the midst of coming out of a long drought, and fortunately, I think we're on the recovery. And by golly, it's just too bad that last year they passed House Bill 3055 that ties our state to the Water for 2060 Act. Says the policy of the state of Oklahoma will be to consume no more fresh water in the year
2060
than was consumed in the year 2012, and that was a drought year.
Yep. And you and I were both at a conference down in Oklahoma City, and I learned while we were down there that they are still on water rationing because a little west of the city, where their primary source of water is, they are still in a drought. So it feels good up here, but it's still a drought condition down there because of their sources.
It will get better, though. It always does. We are delighted today to have as our special guest Congressman Jim Bridenstine.
Absolutely. He's becoming a rock star, as politicians go.
We're broadcasting from the 1st District of Oklahoma, and Congressman Bridenstine, Jim Bridenstine, is our guest. And I'll give you a couple paragraphs of information about his biography, which he's crammed in a lot of things in his short life.
Listen carefully.
Congressman Jim Bridenstine is a Navy pilot and combat veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan and lives in Tulsa with his wife Michelle and their three children. Bridenstine graduated from Rice University with, get this, degrees in economics, business, and psychology. The psychology comes in handy in D.C. After college, he joined the Navy and became a pilot, flying combat missions off the USS Abraham Lincoln in Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan, Operation Southern Watch in Iraq, and Operation Shock and Awe in Iraq. Later, he transitioned to the F-18 Hornet fighter at the Naval Strike and Air Warfare Center, the parent command to Top Gun, where he flew Red Air and was also an instructor. After leaving active duty, Bridenstine earned an MBA from Cornell University and returned to Tulsa to be the executive director of the Tulsa Air and Space Museum and Planetarium. Now, that's where we started hearing about him.
That's right.
He was recently promoted to the rank of lieutenant commander in the U.S. Navy Reserve, where he flies the E-2C Hawkeye, a surveillance and operations command aircraft in Central and South America in support of America's war on drugs. Congressman Bridenstine, welcome to our show.
Well, thank you, Amanda and Don. I appreciate you guys for having me. I want to be, I think I need to update that bio a bit.
Past tense?
Well, yeah, so I flew with the United States Navy Reserve up until the day I got sworn in.
There you go.
And as a member of Congress, I'm now what they call, quote, key personnel. So I'm not deployable, and I can't get paid to drill. And so I'm not eligible to fly anymore. although I still do, I drill with the United States Navy Reserve just as a regular, sailor. I don't get to fly anymore. Although, should I lose an election or should I choose not to run again, I could certainly fly again, and I might take that up as an option should I get too frustrated in this town, Washington.
One of the stats I've heard you mention, and I didn't see in your bio, is how many carrier-arrested landings you've had.
So, yeah, I've had 333 carrier-arrested landings, and that would include probably about half, well, maybe a little less than half of them at nighttime. And that includes both, as pilot and co-pilot. So the challenge there is when you're flying an airplane to land on an aircraft carrier, it's a little bit daunting.
Well, it's
even worse when you have to ride along and somebody else is at the controls.
When you use some of these flight simulator games that try to illustrate what that's like, it feels like you're trying to set a 747 down on a postage stamp. The postage stamp is moving in the process. So.
It's one of those things that you never get used to.
I bet.
I was, when I was in the Navy, they would show videos of certain, carrier landings from the cockpit perspective just to kind of show, what the pilot was looking at and help you make decisions. They show you basically accidents,
Yeah, right.
And even when you're watching, you're sitting at a desk, watching a video.
It still makes your stomach flip.
Oh yeah, your heart races, your palms sweat, and you're just sitting at a desk, but it doesn't matter. It's like it's part of that, uncontrolled response when you do that kind of work.
It's a really intense process, isn't it?
It is, and I miss it, but there's a lot of important work that needs to be done here in Washington D.C. And this is an honor of a lifetime. It truly is. It's a privilege, and I appreciate you guys. I mean, you guys are the grassroots there that are holding members of Congress and other elected officials accountable, which is something we need desperately in this country. And I know how hard you guys work. You guys know the bills that we pass better than we do in many cases. And that's important to hold us accountable when we're in this line of work.
Well, it wouldn't be possible without a lot of people working together.
That's true.
With common objectives.
We were
just talking about
that before we went on
Oklahoma
air
is very fortunate in that the grassroots groups do work together for the most part.
Right.
And
right.
That's a good thing. And I think your background training and experience has helped you to understand that you need to stand up and take strong positions when you need to. And one of the first votes, I think it was your first vote, was to vote no on to reelect John Boehner as Speaker of the House, which was a campaign promise. And that kind of set the tone and got some attention. So we appreciate that. And it is a 2-year term, so keep voting right. Everything should be okay. All right. Today we're going to be talking about immigration reform or border security. It's got several other names, really. It's content and the current status. There's a Senate Bill 744 was passed by the Senate, which is a horrible bill. And it's supposedly DOA, dead on arrival, in the House. We're also going to be talking about the controversial farm bill. And time permitting, we will review the House efforts to repeal the Unaffordable Care Act, Don.
That's what we call it, the Unaffordable Care Act.
And CISPA, which is Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act. We may not get to that one, but I hope we do.
I hope we do, too.
All right.
And we should also warn our listeners that Jim is currently in Washington, D.C., at the House, in his office, and has been pulled out for various kinds of testimony and votes, and it is possible that before this broadcast is at its scheduled conclusion, Jim will have to leave us, and we've already worked it out with Jim that if that happens, he just has to accept his priorities and let us know, and he'll disappear on us, but hopefully that won't happen.
I think my constituents will understand if I have to hang up on you guys to go vote.
Absolutely.
And it's not a vote. It's a testimony about a provision in the defense appropriations bill that we're about to vote on and pass.
Exactly. And that's actually the Rules Committee, I understand, that you're doing some testimony for?
That's correct. And I'll just be quick. What we're doing, the Department of Defense is not unlike any other agency in the federal government in that it spends a tremendous amount of money on programs and things that it ought not spend money on. And one of the things that, as a member of the military that I saw frequently, was how much money we spend for what they call defense media activities. Things like the Pentagon Channel, and which nobody watches. And in fact, I've seen it, only displayed in one location my entire time in the Navy.
Wow.
And nobody watched it. but there are other publications, websites, magazines, entertainment channels, all kinds of things that the defense media activity is involved in that are, in my opinion, a big waste of taxpayer dollars. And my goal in my amendment here is to shift some of that money over to more important things that the Department of Defense does. For example, the National Guard State Partnership Program. That's specifically where I want the money routed. And that, what that is, for Oklahomans, the State Partnership Program is how the Oklahoma National Guard, they actually work with Azerbaijan, which is a nation just south of Russia, just north of Iran, next to the Caspian Sea. It's a very important country geographically. And so what happens is the Oklahoma National Guard has this relationship with Azerbaijan where they exchange subject matter experts, and they have senior-ranking officials go back and forth and share information. They even embed, our soldiers with their soldiers in some cases, and they train on technologies and equipment so that if we do have some kind of joint security issue, which you can imagine being in between Russia and Iran,
right?
there's definitely some joint security issues there. The Oklahoma National Guard has already worked with, trained with, been a part of what they're doing over there, and there's interoperability that otherwise wouldn't exist. So it's not like we're starting from scratch trying to build a relationship should, Iran, make it necessary to use a nuclear weapon somewhere, for example.
Something tells me that has something to do with oil supply.
Well, there's definitely that. When you think about this, so Azerbaijan is right next to the Caspian Sea.
Right.
And the Caspian Sea has all kinds of oil, and that's, you've got a lot of, stress, if you will, between Russia and Iran and Azerbaijan on that part of the world because of the energy resources.
Right.
And, what I think our national, when we talk about American national security, you're talking about really how does a country like Azerbaijan maintain its freedom and independence as a former Soviet satellite state, and how do we encourage them to have the institutions for stability apart from being dependent on Russia? And those institutions include things like the freedom of press, the freedom of religion, the ability to criticize your public officials and not worry about going to jail. These are the institutions that we take for granted in the United States, but they're completely foreign to a lot of these countries that have been oppressed for so many years.
True.
And so when we have these partnerships, the intent is, to build these relationships, not just because there's a security interest in the Caspian for energy, although there is that. And that interest is not just for the oil in the Caspian, because, we don't make use of that oil, but that oil goes through a pipeline through the South Caucasus.
That's
so
right.
It goes through Georgia, and it goes through Turkey, and then it goes over to Eastern Europe, which is critically important, because Eastern Europe, they get their energy shut off in the dead of winter by the Russians if they try to have any kind of independence from Russia.
Right.
And so the idea here is we want, as much as possible to have an influence in freedom and really stability. I mean, that's the key thing.
Right.
And, you know, the long-term interest and stability is institutions that we hold dear that many times we take for granted. But so it's really a small transfer of money from, you know, the the Pentagon Channel,
right,
to the Oklahoman, and not just Oklahoma, but all the National Guard programs,
right,
so that they can better integrate with some of our partners around the world, especially those partners that are working excessively hard to maintain their freedom and independence,
right,
and in many cases are being snubbed by the President of the United States.
Jim, I hate to interrupt, and I know that our time is going to run out before either of us wish it were, but
sure,
let's move on, if we could, and if you're willing, to the subject of immigration reform. In late June, the Senate passed Senate Bill 744, ostensibly an immigration bill, but we did a show on that recently from some research and analysis. We think it was really more of a trade bill and had a lot more to do with new kinds of visas than it did most things that are most commonly associated with it, like amnesty. But
right,
maybe you can share with us if you think that is in fact the case, and what you think the House version of immigration reform might turn out looking like.
Excellent line of questions there. So the Senate bill is a disaster, quite frankly. And what it is, it's legalization first, and then enforcement later.
Maybe.
Right, maybe. That's the key word, exactly. So we've been down this road before. It doesn't work. They never follow through on the enforcement measures, but they always follow through on the legalization measures.
Right.
So the key here is the Senate bill, when it comes over to the House, there's all kinds of problems with it. You know, they called it, there's so many issues with it. They called it the border surge, where you have 20,000 new border patrol agents. You've got all this new fencing and all these new technologies, and all of it just sounds like it's a very secure border kind of situation.
They would have us believe that they're already done with that effort, wouldn't they?
That's it. And here's the interesting thing. The Secretary of Homeland Security, who's currently Janet Napolitano, she has no interest. She'll tell you right now that the borders are secure. And in the bill, as much as it looks like it's securing the border, it gives the Secretary of Homeland Security the ability to waive all of these efforts to secure the border. So it's really not a serious effort to try to secure the border. In fact, it's intentional in my opinion, it's a shiny object. And then it says, okay, right, members of Congress, look over here at this shiny object. And then, you know, they divert everything the direction they want it to go later.
It's a David Copperfield stunt, isn't it?
That's right.
I once heard the head of the Tucson sector for the Border Patrol explaining to one of our groups there in southern Arizona that their target, their goal for interception and apprehension of illegal border crossers was 29%. And
right,
I've thought ever since then that even if they achieved their goal, 100% of their goal, that's a pretty pathetic expectation. And I know for a fact that they don't achieve that. So it's
right,
really pretty sad right there in the Tucson sector for sure.
Right, but this is what's so astonishing. How do you measure it? If you don't catch them, how do you know how many came across that you didn't catch?
Because
you know?
I understand that through surveillance, they see them, and they
right,
from one chain of command, they report them to the Border Patrol, and once upon a time, the Border Patrol would respond, and they're no longer responding even.
Right. So the key element that we have to make sure happens first in any immigration bill is border security first, and also interior enforcement.
Right.
You know, you hear this a lot. Well, it's not about the border. 40% of the people that are here illegally are here because they overstayed their visas.
Right.
And you 40%, that's the number they keep saying. And the challenge is, well, how do you make sure that people don't overstay their visas? So we need to have some kind of mechanism to where if somebody comes to the United States, there's an in-check, and then they need to have an out-check so that we can determine who is here legally, and who has left according to what their visa required them to do. And if you overstay your visa, we need to make sure that people understand that's a violation of our law. If you come across the border, people need to know that that's a violation of our law, and people will be held accountable for that.
I can remember as a kid growing up, there were public service announcements reminding people to register for Selective Service, and if you were here on a visa, you had to go do your check-in once a year or whatever the regulation was at the time. And you sure don't see that kind of thing anymore now.
That's right. And the other thing is, whether it's a work visa or an education visa, here's the one of the biggest problems, in my opinion, with the Senate bill, is they have prevailing wage requirements.
That's true.
Which means that the businesses that want to, if you want to get, say, a work visa for whatever area of work it may be, let's say you have a farm and you want to get an agricultural work visa. Well, the prevailing wage might be, say, $8 an hour. And so when you fill out your paperwork to get a visa, you're going to have to prove to the federal government that you're paying the prevailing wage. You're going to have to pay fees. You're going to have to, you know, open yourself up to having, you know, people check on your business to make sure that, you know, you're not, you know, abusing your worker that is there on a visa. Because remember, if you come in on a visa, you can't just transfer jobs. You're not mobile. You have to work for the company that brought you over on the visa.
There are a couple of exceptions.
So you're opening yourself to all this government scrutiny and regulation and these prevailing wages that you have to pay. At the end of the day, the worker or the employer is just going to say, you know, it's not worth it for me to go through this process.
Exactly.
And so at the end of the day, you don't get the labor that you were looking for. And in fact, what ends up happening is it encourages more illegal immigration.
Absolutely.
Because there will always be workers that want to get under the prevailing wage, and there will always be businesses that want to get under the prevailing wage, and there will always be workers that are willing to come here and work for under that amount, since there are restrictions on the number of visas that are authorized anyway. So as long as we have a porous border, and people overstay their visas, and we have a prevailing wage, as long as those things continue, there is not going to be anything that's effective when it comes to immigration reform.
I think where the misdirection is taking place is that there are different kinds of immigrants and non-immigrants that are mentioned in these pieces of legislation. I found three, at least, on the House side that Eric Cantor mentioned in his memo to the House members. And one is called the Skills Act, the other one is called SAFE, and then there's another one. Those two were passed by the Judiciary Committee, and then another one's called the Border Security Results Act of 2013.
Yeah.
So I can get you those numbers. But the one that I'm concerned about, actually I'm concerned about all of them, but the one that I'm concerned about is H.R. 2131, Supplying Knowledge-Based Immigrants and Lifting Levels of STEM Visas Act, shortened as the Skills Visa Act, and this is Congressman Issa's Act.
Daryl
Issa's thing. But he has this increase of green cards by up to 55,000 green cards a year for employers to petition for foreign graduates of U.S. universities with advanced degrees in STEM. STEM is science, technology, engineering, and math. Well, that was the same thing that was mentioned in Senate Bill 744 from the Senate side. It's this part of this global economy is that we're going to import or promote foreign-born students in this country, and they're going to get first priority on these STEM jobs over American students. And that's what the gist of these bills are. That's why they're more trade-oriented than anything what I call immigration. So we're looking, people think in this country, oh, they're crossing the border from Mexico or South America, and they're coming into this country illegally.
Is some of that.
That's
what they focused on almost exclusively in the PR.
But the gist of this bill is the STEM jobs, which are supposed to be the high-paying jobs that our children, that our students from the universities are supposed to transition into, but we're increasing the number of visas, green card visas, for these high-paying, what they call high-skill jobs, for foreigners.
That's
what's happening.
Yeah, my philosophy on this is, when you try to control the labor force in that fashion, you don't get the most efficient economy.
Right.
And it almost seems like it's centralized planning
exactly,
of an economy.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
And we're allowing the people that some bureaucrat somewhere determines is the right person, and the person that the bureaucrat determines is the wrong person doesn't get in. It ends up looking a lot like, you know, central planning of an economy.
Well, what we have is actually called the global economy, which equals no borders, a mobile workforce, reduced wages, and a lower standard of living for Americans.
And a lot less people, too. That's a separate subject.
Yeah. That's the music indicating the end of the first half of America in the Balance. Our special guest today is Congressman Jim Bridenstine from the 1st District of Oklahoma. Stick around through the bottom of the hour, and we'll be right back.
And welcome back to the second half of America in the Balance on Truth in Focus Internet Radio. This is Amanda Teagarden in studio with Don Wyatt.
Delighted to be here. I think you outdid yourself on that selection. That's fun. It's a song from a movie called Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? That
one of
George
my
Clooney.
Most favorite movies. Do you like that movie?
It's the first time I saw it. I thought this is crazy. I have no idea what's going on. It takes a couple of times or a brighter person to understand what the movie's about.
It was based on Homer.
Probably. Yeah, probably.
Our guest today is Congressman Jim Bridenstine, who may or may not still be there after that long
story. Oh, I'm here.
Are you? I'm going to tell you a funny thing about this. I usually try to pick music that's appropriate to the subject of the show. And, of course, this is kind of constant sorrow here with the immigration bill. But I was also, because Don and I are baby boomer age and you're the younger generation, and we're not holding that against you or anything, but I was trying to find songs that would be appropriate for when you were younger, and so I'm picking in the 90s, and it's like, dude, it's crap for songs. There is nothing. I wasted an hour and a half trying to pick, what are the top hits of the 90s? It's like, this was really bad music. Let's see, MC Hammer, Vanilla Ice, Mariah Carey, it's like, holy crap, Backstreet Boys, NSYNC, Green Day. I was like, yeah, Where did they all go?
We don't want to offend anybody, but...
Sorry. Sorry.
What's wrong with MC Hammer? And you got to throw in Vanilla Ice, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
I almost picked that one.
I like his show on Home and Garden TV. He's quite a builder. He's got really good taste, by the way.
I'm glad he had another job. He was really good. All right, we were talking about immigration reform, and so we can get back to this. And House... H.R. 2131 at the passed out of the Judiciary Committee on the House side. This is Congress. And it's called the STEM Skills Visa Act. And the thing that you were just talking about that was in the Senate bill with the prevailing wages, Congressman Issa has included here market-based approach to protect American workers. The bill improves the prevailing wage calculation to better protect American workers and extends the prevailing wage protection to similar visa programs. So it's exactly the same thing. I'm going to read what Chairman Goodlatte wrote in his press release on this. He says, in today's global economy, our nation needs access to the world's best talent to maintain our competitive edge. Although high-skilled immigrants are often in demand by American employers, many of them end up on the green card waiting list for years. This is called the rationale. Okay. Consequently, many of these foreign workers and students go back to their home countries and work for one of our global competitors. Well, I have a question on here. Who's a global competitor? Since all these companies that are hiring are traditionally multinational corporations who have offices all over the world, right. Who's the global competitor?
I think what they're talking about is not necessarily a global competitor in the sense of a foreign firm. I think what they're talking about is just that whatever business is out there, that particular worker might go to a different country, and then that country would benefit from that worker's skill. Real quick, I just want to be clear. I'm not defending.
Right.
I'm not defending the amendment there.
Oh, we understand.
What I would say is that when you look at what we're going to do in the House, first of all, the Senate bill that we talked about previously is not going to work in the House of Representatives for passage. And I think what and I'm not in the leadership, so I don't get to pick what we vote on. But I do get to make my votes, and I do hear about what might be coming forward. And what I understand is we're going to have a vote on a border security bill, and that border security bill is going to be only border security. And the interesting thing is going to be, what do the Democrats do? Like, if we bring forth a bill that is only border security, are all the Democrats going to vote against it? And, because Democrats have, one thing in mind. They want comprehensive. And the reason they want comprehensive is because, they want the amnesty provision.
Right.
So if we bring forth a border security bill and all the Democrats vote against it, and then we bring forth an interior enforcement bill that would include, visa overstays and and E-Verify, and we pass those two bills and all the Democrats vote against them, then the question becomes, are they serious about immigration reform? Why is it that they only want the amnesty provisions? And you can't have the amnesty provisions and an open border. And here's where we come to the realization that the Democrats are not serious on these bills. They have an agenda.
Right.
And that agenda is not in the national security interest of the United States.
Right. Well, that kind of bill has already been passed back in 86. I remember it vividly.
And it passed in the Senate just a few weeks ago.
That's right. That's right. Exactly.
And that's why we've got to make sure that it doesn't happen again. And so then the question becomes, once we put Democrats on record, you know, and we'll see what they do. I don't know. Maybe they'll vote for it. We're going to find out. But if they're not willing to vote on that stuff, then, you know, we don't really need to go any further, because we're demonstrating what they're interested in. And they're not interested in the security elements. They're only interested in the amnesty elements. Right. And that's abundantly apparent based on what passed out of the Senate.
Right.
The bill you're talking about might be H.R. 1417, the Border Security Results Act, by Chairman Michael McCaul out of Texas.
Yes.
Okay, that one has an... it's like, oh, great, more drones. Okay, sorry. Okay, never mind. We're going to go move on to the farm bill. Okay. The farm bill. We have five congressmen in the state of Oklahoma, one of whom is Congressman Frank Lucas, and he authored H.R. 2642, which was called the Federal Agricultural Reform and Risk Management Act of 2013, commonly called the Farm Bill. This bill typically blends two things together, farm subsidies, let's call it that, and food stamp program.
Right.
It was and continues to be a controversial bill, and it ties those two disparate subjects together, and I believe that the vote was recently made to separate the two.
Right. We should add that Congressman Lucas is the chairman of the Agriculture Committee, too.
He is, and I will tell you, he's from the 3rd District of Oklahoma. All congressmen in Oklahoma currently are Republicans, and my personal opinion on Congressman Lucas is that he's been kind of flying under the radar for years. Very popular, has a lot of rural counties. There are 77 counties in the state of Oklahoma, and he's got a huge district, but not heavily populated. Of course, population is relatively equal between all the districts, but his square mile wise is
spread
out. Right. Tell us about this. Now, there was a lot of discussion about a controversial vote on this to separate. Well, give us a synopsis of the farm bill and why those two things were put together and how they got separated.
Okay, so you got when you think about the farm bill, you've got provisions for insurance for farmers, and you've got provisions for basically subsidies in various forms for farmers on one hand, and on the other hand, you've got 82% of the bill, which is food stamps. And so we have had this unholy alliance between members of Congress from rural areas that want more farm provisions, and members of Congress from, you know, urban areas that want more food stamps. And this unholy alliance was put together back in 1970.
Right, long time ago.
Yeah, a long time ago. I think at the time it was Bob Dole, I think, was chairman of the Ag Committee. And I could be wrong on that, but that's what I believe the case was. Anyway, so we have had this unholy alliance where both programs really are impenetrable. You can't really get real reforms on either program. They're both destined to grow as long as this alliance exists, because members of Congress from both sides are going to be able to continue growing those programs, you know, without us being able to stop it.
And we've seen the data on how much more the food stamp program has grown in last couple of administrations, and this explains why and how.
That's right. And if you look, you know, under President Bush, food stamps doubled.
That's right.
And then under President Obama, food stamps have already doubled again.
That's right.
And interestingly, it was part of the Obama stimulus package. So we're going to stimulate the economy by incentivizing a whole bunch of people to not work. It doesn't make any sense, but that's how they passed all these increases in food stamps.
That's true. Go ahead. I'm sorry. There was a bill already passed in the Senate that still combined those two ingredients, I think. Wasn't there? What's the status of that?
I'm not too sure where they are in the Senate right now.
But what you're trying to do in the House, anyway, is...
Yeah, so what we did in the House, there was about 62 Republicans that said, we're not going to vote for any farm bill that includes the farm provisions combined with the food stamp provisions. Each one of those bills needs to stand on its own merit. And so in the House, you know, there were 62 of us Republicans, conservative Republicans, that said, we're not going to vote for anything as long as they're combined. And the other thing is they have this 1949 law that's permanent law, and they hit you on the head and they say, you have to pass this bill because if you don't, then the Farm Bill reverts to 1949, which has a whole lot more egregious, you know, provisions, including, you know, provisions that'll make the, you know, the price of a gallon of milk go up to, you know, $8 a gallon or whatever it is. So what we had to do is 62 of us stood strong and we said we're not going to vote on a farm bill as long as it is combined farm and food stamps. Now there was an amendment given on the food stamp side. There was an amendment given: if you are going to receive food stamps, you have to prove that you are either, you know, that you are attempting to work. And when that amendment passed, a whole lot of Democrats pulled their support from the bill and said, we're not voting for this because we don't want the people on food stamps to have to prove that they're trying to work. And so once the Democrats left the farm bill, then all of a sudden the 62 of us on the Republican side that were holding firm, we all of a sudden became very relevant.
Well said.
And so we ultimately, we all stood firm and we didn't vote for the bill and it died on the floor of the House. And it was for a freshman member of Congress, that was something I've never seen before. You had all 435 members, they weren't all there, but 425 of them were there. And you could have heard a pin drop in that House. I mean, it was, people were just...
They were stunned, weren't they?
Stunned that we had just killed the farm bill. So a couple days later, the majority leader, Eric Cantor, asked a number of us freshmen to come and talk to him about this. And he said, okay, we want to pass a farm bill. And he said, there's a lot of pressure to, you know, maybe go the other direction. How do we get this done? And, you know, we gave him two requirements. Number one, we need to get rid of the 1949 law, which is always used to force us to vote on bad legislation because the alternative is worse. And number two, we need to split the food stamps from the farm bill. And he talked about how, you know, if we go that direction, you know, he said, we're not going to get a single Democrat, not one. And he said, so if I go that direction, you guys can't pull the rug out from under me. And he goes, I'm not too sure we can get it done even with that. But he goes, if we go that direction, will you guys be there to vote for it? And I was non-committal at that point. But later, after the 4th of July break, we went back, we came back, and he called me. And he said, Jim, if we go this direction, are you gonna vote for it? We got to know because we got to make a decision here. And I gave him my word. I said, Eric, if you go that direction, because there was a lot of talk about going the other way. Like, and when I say going the other way, I'm talking about adding more food stamps to the bill in order to get more Democrats on board. And I said, Eric, if you go our way and you split the food stamps from the farm bill and make it two separate provisions, two separate bills, and if you, you know, repeal the 1949 law, you know, I'll vote for it. And then, you know, the vote came. And a lot of conservative groups scored against it.
That's right.
And of course, you know, at that point, I was kind of, you know, taken aback because, you know, those same conservative groups were advocating for the split. They wanted the split and they wanted the repeal of 1949. And don't get me wrong, I am not suggesting in any way that this is the bill that I would have preferred.
Sure.
But if you want to make a big policy shift, and if you want to eventually get to more free markets, then this is what was required. We had to split these two bills apart so that we could break up this unholy alliance.
Right. And some of the conservative groups, in their defense, were unhappy with some of the other stuff that got put in it anyway. And you and I have actually spoken in another venue about that, and I understand your dilemma.
Right. And there's no doubt. Look, it's a subsidy bill. I mean, it's corporate welfare. There's nothing about this bill in general that is attractive to me as somebody who believes in free markets.
What you like about it, though, is the fact that you achieved a policy shift in splitting them, and I understand that
could bode very well for us in the future in getting back to more of a free market model.
Right.
That we need to achieve.
What do you think is going to happen as this moves on through the House and then over to the Senate? Are they going to put those back together?
Yeah,
again?
So obviously the Senate is loaded with Democrats that don't want to see the food stamps removed, and so they'll pass a bill that's combined, and then it goes to what's called conference committee, and this is where the rubber hits the road. The House appoints some conferees, the Senate appoints conferees, and they will negotiate a settlement on, what comes out of that conference committee. And the question is, what will that look like? And if it looks like the original farm bill, then, obviously I'm going to vote against it and be tremendously disappointed.
Right.
But the other thing is that's true is whether or not we pass the farm bill or not, that doesn't prevent the speaker from appointing conferees anyway. So a lot of people say you got to vote against everything because if you vote for anything, then it'll go to conference. Well, there's no requirement that you pass something in order for it to go to conference anyway. And I can give you a perfect example of something that drew me into this race was the super committee. The super committee was nothing more and nothing less than a conference committee without any previous votes. The super committee was 12 members of Congress, 6 from the House, 6 from the Senate, 6 Democrats, 6 Republicans. None of them happened to be from Oklahoma. You guys remember this from the Budget Control Act of 2011.
Absolutely.
And these 12 members had the full authority to, raise taxes, change federal spending. There would be no debate, no amendments, no filibuster.
That's right.
There would be an up or down vote on the floor of the House, an up or down vote on the floor of the Senate. And in my in my opinion, that was not what was intended by the founding fathers.
Now, it takes leadership from both House and Senate to put a strategy like that in place, doesn't it? They have to both agree basically to appoint a conference committee.
That's correct. Yeah. So what happens now is it goes to what they call an informal conference, which basically you've got people that are over there talking about, what we could agree upon. But it's not in an actual conference. Once you assign a conference committee, you're pretty much guaranteed that it's going to come back for a vote in whatever that conference committee, it's like the pre-negotiation to the negotiation.
Right. Right.
What are your, non-negotiable, requirements,
right,
and what are my non-negotiable requirements? And if there is no, end game, then it never goes to conference and we never vote on it, period.
Well, that probably...
And if you look at the Ryan budget in the House and, of course, the Harry Reid budget in the Senate, you've got the same type of thing going on where there is no conference committee because there's no agreement on how to reconcile these two budgets.
Will it be after the August break before anything next happens on that, do you think?
On the farm bill?
Yes.
I'm not sure on that right now.
Okay.
It could be. We'll have to see. I'm not sure.
All right.
So what else you guys, farm bill, what else...
Thanks for the segue. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's change subjects.
That's more about farm probably, Bill, than most people ever care to know about.
Well, but that's important here in Oklahoma.
Interject here. I was looking at the latest version of the farm bill. It's 1,142 pages long.
Right.
Okay.
And there's energy in there. There's all kinds of stuff in there. The SNAP food program is still in there. There's... It's not single subject.
Yeah, it's never
clean.
Okay,
go ahead, Don.
Let's go ahead and switch gears now to what we call the Unaffordable Care Act, simply because we think that's a lot more correctly descriptive than calling it the Affordable Care Act. Tell us what is going on in the House, some of the involvement you've already had there, and what you see coming.
Sure. Okay, so the Unaffordable Care Act, I prefer to call it Obamacare.
Right.
But, you know, I've, of course, campaigned hard saying we need to, you know, defund it, we need to repeal it, we need to do whatever we can do to get rid of this bill because it is so egregious. And I can go into all the detail there, but we probably don't have time. But here's where we are on the repeal of it. We have voted in the House to repeal it. Of course, the Senate won't ever take that up. What we need to do is we need to tie the defunding of Obamacare to what some people call must-pass legislation. And that means things like the debt limit increase or a continuing resolution, the items that we use to fund the government. And if we could tie it to that, then we could actually force, and here's the question, and people, some people will say, on the Republican side, they will say, well, if you tie it to the debt limit increase, then the Senate will do a clean debt limit increase without repealing Obamacare.
Right.
And at the end, you have two debt limit increases that don't reconcile, and you're heading towards a government shutdown.
Right.
You're heading towards default on our bonds. You're heading towards, you know, these things, and it will ruin our creditworthiness, is what they say, and it will ruin our it'll make the markets decline. And at the end of the day, we as Republicans will lose in 2014.
Right.
And I argue just the opposite. If we believe what we say we believe, and we hold firm to that, and we force the Senate Democrats to defend Obamacare again, It's not a winner for them, and oh, by the way, if we actually resolved this with a victory, the markets will come back, the creditworthiness of the United States will come back, and we will have economic growth again in our country.
Right.
A big thing that's holding our country back right now is just the uncertainty that comes with Obamacare.
It's pervasive.
It is, and so. So the key is we have as Republicans, we have the moral high ground on this. The public is against the Affordable Care Act. I even have Democrats that have written me letters, and they said, "I'm a Democrat.
Kill it.
I didn't vote for you, and I never will vote for you. But you have got to do something to get rid of the Affordable Care Act."
That's right.
And Democrats are against this. Democrats in the Senate have called it a train wreck.
That's,
you know,
true.
The president just waved a huge, you know, the employer mandate. He just waved it.
That's right.
And here's what's interesting: the president waved, and I don't know how he does this constitutionally. Some provisions in the IRS. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know, and it could very well not be legal. But when he just puts off the employer mandate the way he did,
just declaring that he's not going to enforce it as though it weren't there.
That's it. He's not going to enforce the law. Have we heard this before from this president?
Yes.
He picks and chooses what he wants to enforce.
That's
the
right.
Imperial presidency. But at the end of the day, where we go with this is we passed out of the House of Representatives a bill that would put off the employer mandate for a year.
Right.
And the president threatened to veto it.
Exactly, which he's already announced he's done.
Right, so he doesn't want to repeal, he doesn't want to put the law off for a year.
Right.
He wants to leave the law in place and then use his executive powers to not enforce the law. Well, read the Constitution. His job is to enforce the law.
Right.
That is what his job is as President of the United States. He doesn't just get to pick and choose what laws that he enforces.
Apparently he thinks he does.
Well, delayed employer mandate for a year is an indication that the bill was too haphazard anyway when it was all
right.
Thrown together. It should not have passed to begin with. And
right.
By the way, the states are still implementing it
piecemeal,
including the state of Oklahoma. So we've got our work cut out for us here because it's being implemented through the Oklahoma Healthcare Authority. Real quick, we've got about 1 minute left on the CISPA, Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act. The House passed it, but you voted no. Thank you on that. That would have allowed the sharing of internet traffic information between U.S. government and technology and manufacturing companies, which kind of way, if you've got Yahoo or Gmail or whatever, all your emails
seems
are being
to be
read.
Happening
NSA,
anyway, yeah.
Right? Everything is happening. And by the way, everything that Edward Snowden said, we already knew. So I don't even know why the guy's on the run.
good point.
But just real quick, and then I have an action item for our listeners.
Okay, so on CISPA, there were provisions of it that I think were actually good. It is absolutely true that the U.S. government has, you know, knowledge of viruses that exist out there that are classified. And there is a Department of Defense program. It's called the Defense Industrial Complex Pilot Program. And what it does is it says if you have classified documents or some kind of classified program and you want to protect yourself from these threat viruses from foreign countries, you know, the NSA will share that information with you as a defense contractor so that you can protect yourself. But it's all got to be classified to protect, you know, sources and methods. And so when the federal government wants to share that kind of classified information with private companies in order to protect them, I think that's a good thing. And I'd really like to support a measure that encourages that kind of information sharing from the federal government to private companies. The challenge is when the government gives private companies immunity, right, to share, you know, if you and I have a contract with, say, our bank, and then our bank, that contract says that they're not going to share our information with the government, and then our bank is given immunity by the federal government to share that information with the government. Now the contract that you and I have with our bank is in essence unenforceable. So the bank can share at that point your information with the federal government, and that I think is what gave a lot of us pause on this bill. I have no problem if the federal government has classified information that they would like to share with private companies in order to protect their security. I think that's a good thing. But when the federal government wants to take private information from individuals outside of their will, they don't want that to happen, and those companies then have the authority to share it with the federal government, then I think that is a stretch beyond what most people are comfortable with.
Right. When the government engages in public-private partnerships, which is what you're describing there, it does end up growing government, which is a serious concern with that, and it is what the government cannot do, the private sector can do for them.
And it makes our governance less accountable.
It does.
We can't get at those guys.
We can't. Right. And generally, contractors subcontract out work.
Exactly.
We had that here in Oklahoma with Capgemini, and they subcontracted out to a company. And by golly, where is that company? It's in China.
Yep.
Okay. All right. We have an action item for our legislators. We have an active bill in the Oklahoma legislature, Senate Bill 254, linking the Oklahoma Health Care Authority to the IRS, which is completely unnecessary. So the House number is 800-522-8502. The Senate is 800-865-6490. Congressman Jim Bridenstine, you're a great guest. We'd love to have you back again, and thank you for what you're doing in D.C.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
It's been our pleasure. All right. We want to thank our listeners for tuning in to another hour of America in the Balance on Truth in Focus Internet Radio. We thank you for listening, and may God bless you.